So, please turn to the book of Job, if you're not there already. Thus begins, in our survey of the Bible, our entrance into the wisdom literature section, Hebrew poetry section. And so we've kind of left the continuous narrative that we've been on to this point, pretty continuous narrative, from Genesis through the period of the Exodus, Judges, Israel, the kingdom, the civil war, the Assyrian conquest of the northern kingdom, the Babylonian conquest of the southern kingdom. Then when the Persians take over, they send the Jews back. The temple and the walls are rebuilt. We've kind of left that whole storyline now. And that's one of the difficulties in dealing especially with Job, because listening to a few different folks, one tried to reconnect it to redemptive history, but for the most part, we often read this as kind of an isolated tale. And there can be, I think there can be value gained in both approaches. But we don't want to read this as kind of a Hebrew Aesop's fable. We don't want to read it like that. Now, to begin, just with the title, you won't be surprised. Hebrew, Greek, Latin titles are all Job. So, nothing surprising there. Nothing particularly noteworthy there. We don't really know what his name means. It seems that in chapter 13, verse 24, there is some wordplay in Job, because the word for enemy, have you made me your enemy, the word for enemy has the same Hebrew consonants as Job. So there might be some wordplay with his name. Some scholars suggest his name could mean fatherless. Either way, it's not a very optimistic picture of what his name might mean, which kind of fits with a lot of what we see in the book. Now, like I said, there are some that want to take this book and make it entirely fictitious, that this is kind of a morality tale in the Hebrew tradition, and I don't think that's an option for us if we want to have a high view of Scripture. We see Job referenced in Ezekiel chapter 14, verses 14 and 20. They both basically say the same thing. They reference Job with Noah and Daniel as these kind of ideal intercessors, that even if these men were here interceding for wicked Judah, they would only save themselves, they wouldn't save Judah. But Job is lifted up there as this pinnacle of what a good intercessor is. And James mentions Job in chapter 5. If you'll turn there real quick, we can see this. James chapter 5, verse 11. Well, the paragraph talks about patience and suffering, and the paragraph ends with a reference to Job in verse 11. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Either way, or with both texts, James and Ezekiel both seem to assume that Job was a historical person. And I think it makes things needlessly difficult if we're going to try and see Job as a mythic figure, somebody who didn't actually exist. Furthermore, while we're talking about that kind of thing, we can say right off the bat that if we view this as an isolated tale that's kind of fictitious, we're tempted to think this is a story about a man named Job. But it's not, even though the title is Job. The book is not even about suffering in general. The book is about God and whether he is a just governor of this universe, whether he justly governs this world that is so filled with suffering. That's really what the book is about. Now, as far as the author goes, it's anonymous. It's certainly not Job. I think we can say with confidence that it's not Job. The prologue makes no sense with the rest of the content of the book if Job is the author, because a lot of Job's questions would be answered if Job knew the contents of the prologue, meaning chapters 1 and 2, the heavenly council, Satan, and the angels before God. If Job knows all that happens, then a lot of his questions he asks in the narrative are answered. And God never reveals this information to Job in the epilogue. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to think that the author is Job. But we don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us who wrote it. I don't think it's necessarily a big deal that we do know. One interesting thing we could note here is that we do believe the author was a Hebrew, even though Job was not a Hebrew, and the three friends are not Hebrews. Elihu might have been, but we don't know that for sure. But when you read Job in chapters 1 and 2, and when the Lord answers Job in the whirlwind, Yahweh is used a lot to refer to God. Everything in between, it's only used once. And there's other names used for God, either Elohim or Adonai, but Adonai being their actual word for Lord. When you see Lord in all caps in the text, that's Yahweh. That's God's covenant name. But if you see Lord in lowercase caps, it could be Adonai, which is sometimes used as a name for God. But this could be one indication that the author of the book was certainly a Hebrew, and that perhaps this takes place before Abraham, if God's covenant name is not used hardly at all, except for the one exception. I think it's Job 12:9 is the only time in all the dialogues that the name Yahweh is used. We don't know as far as a date. It seems pretty common consensus that this is at least around Abraham's time, could predate Abraham. We don't know for sure. As far as the date of writing, we don't know for sure either. We can say with absolute confidence that it was written before Ezekiel, but we don't know exactly when the book was written. When we're talking about genre, I talked about wisdom literature. The wisdom literature especially includes Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, and wisdom being defined as the skill of living. These books kind of tell you how to live well in from various directions. And Job fits in that mold, especially when we're thinking about suffering, justice, and God and our obligation to him. The comforters, or Job's friends, are like the Pharisees in that they operate with ancient wisdom and wisdom that the world has had throughout all time, that God operates on a strict way of, we might say, retributive. They talk about retribution theology, some of the commentators, the word retribution, the idea that I can define it with Jesus' words, or the Gospel of John's words, John 9:1-2, with the blind man born blind. As he passed by Jesus, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" The idea being, when something bad happens to you, you did something to specifically deserve that bad thing. And when good things happen to you, you did something good to specifically deserve that good thing. And that is the underlying baseline assumption of Job's three friends, and a lot of times Job even. When you read Job's arguments with him, with his friends, he kind of dips back and forth into whether he is operating on that assumption or not. But the friends, they're always operating from that assumption, which If you've read Job before, and you've read all of the middle section with Job and his friends going back and forth, you'll read a lot of stuff that you say, this is true. This is biblical truth that Job's friends are saying. But the problem is it's read through the lens of that retribution principle. So that's where we have to keep that in mind as we're reading. Otherwise, we're going to get very confused when God condemns the three friends at the end. Well, they said a lot of things that were just true, but they weren't thinking about it correctly. So it's wisdom literature. The middle sections, so the prologue and the epilogue aren't necessarily poetry, but everything in the middle is. And when we're looking at poetry, we're thinking of something written to where the form is very intentional, and there's some artistic activity involved in the writing. And when we look at the middle sections, Job and his dialogue with his friends, you see a few literary styles. You see lawsuit language, especially with Job oftentimes saying, if there were someone that could advocate for me, if God would only let me hear, let me state my case, if God would adjudicate. And then at the end where he makes his mistake, he says, I've signed my signature on the accusation. God must come down and hear me. This is all lawsuit language. You see lament, especially in Job 3, which kind of kicks off the whole back and forth of the dialogues. Job 3 is an extended lament where it boils down to essentially he wishes he had never been born. He wishes the day he had been born would be ripped out of the calendar, that there would be no recognition of that day. And so you have multiple laments, but that's the big one. And then you have, of course, the back and forth being disputations. This isn't like a debate that you might expect today where I'm going to give you my 7-point argument and you're going to respond in 7 points to my 7 points, and then we're going to have some rebuttals and that kind of thing. This is more general. Job will give a general argument, and then one of the friends will give a general argument. Job will respond generally, sometimes meeting specific points, but not always. And so that's going to be the way they communicate. If you've watched formal academic debates, it's more like the opening statements, where each side is making a general statement, not necessarily pointing at specific points that the other one's making. Now, sometimes they might, but that's not necessarily the purpose. So that's background information. Are there any questions about the background information so far? If not, that's fine. I just wanted to give opportunity. Caleb?
How did they primarily take the book just based on what it seemed like?
Some folks think this could have been the first book written, as in the writing of it could predate Genesis.
Is it just based on like Hebrew, like how it's written, I guess, or?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I read said that the style of Hebrew would have to make it past 1500 BC, and Moses would have been 1400 BC. So if you take the earliest date, then Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy could have been written after Job, but we don't know. I don't think it's very late, but it's hard to say for sure. And Coley? Not in terms of chronology, but in terms of genre. Yeah. In terms of genre, it's with the other wisdom books.
Yeah.
But perhaps, I don't know if it's intentional or not, but it's the first book in the wisdom literature, then Psalms. So, I mean, it might fit chronologically, but I don't know if it's intentional that it does or not. It just depends on how you would order the book. There are different orderings, not necessarily for Job, but for other books of the Bible in different parts of church history. But I haven't thought a whole lot about that. So, when we come to the outline, I've referenced the outline a bit already. You have a prologue in chapters 1 and 2. And this is where God calls all the angels before him, and also Satan also was among them. And you have the setting given for the book. Well, before I get into that, I'll just give you the outline. So, prologue, chapters 1 and 2. Dialogue, chapters 3 through 27. This is the back and forth between Job and his friends. Monologues, 29 through 42, verse 6. So the monologues include Job's ending remarks, then Elihu, and then the Lord. And then the epilogue, which is the rest of chapter 42, which is verses 7 through 17. So to go back to the prologue, we see the setup given for the book, and it's a clash between God and Satan. We read about this assembly of these angels before God. And it's interesting because verse 6 says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." Now, at minimally, we can say that there's a separation between Satan and the angels. Now, to what extent? Some commentators suggested that this might suggest an intrusion, that Satan kind of comes where he shouldn't. Don't know. Was Satan still allowed or welcomed to come in and out as he pleased at this time? We don't know. But at the very least, Satan is separated. He's different from the other angels in this assembly. And we can see pretty quickly that the Lord is the one who initiates this engagement. Now, a lot of people might find that frustrating because Job undergoes a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, and it's not the devil who begins this engagement. It's the Lord who brings up Job. It says, "Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Now, if you want to read this book in with redemptive history, there's a lot that can be talked about, especially if this is pre-Abrahamic, where there's not a chosen people of God. What's the conflict like between God and Satan when there is no chosen people of God and there's this one uniquely righteous man on earth? The devil can't stand for it, and he won't stand for it, and he seeks to challenge God. Now, the reminder, we've already said this, but again, this shows us immediately that this book isn't really about Job. It's about God and about Satan trying to tear him down as the just judge of the universe. Is God just? Does God run the universe justly? Or, as Satan suggests, do people follow him only for the benefits? Specifically for the earthly benefits. Because, as you can see in the first paragraph, Job is an extremely wealthy man. And in some of the dialogues, he references how Job was such a valued member in the community. Everyone showed respect to him. Princes would shut their mouths in his presence. So he had a lot of benefits. And the devil suggests that Job, and probably anybody who would be faithful to God, is only faithful to God because of what God gives them. In other words, the real accusation, there's nothing in God in and of himself that's worthy of worship. And that's the real sting of the accusation. Nobody's going to worship you just because you're the Lord, that you're good and beautiful and awesome in and of yourself. They only worship you because of the stuff they get. And so you see the real drive of the accusation immediately. Now, Satan, again, shows us the kind of deceiver he is. I like this comment from Meredith Klein. In the temptation in Eden, Satan disparaged God to man. Here, he disparages man to God. And again, this isn't just for Job's sake. This is all with the ultimate goal in mind that Satan, that usurping God's authority. So we know how the story goes from here. God accepts the devil's challenge and gives the devil authority to touch everything he has, and the devil does without mercy. And Job loses everything in an instant. And Job does not sin with his lips, the text tells us. We have a repetition of this event in Job 2. We have a repetition of the dialogue. God calls the heavenly council, the angels. Satan is also among them. God brings up, "Have you considered my servant Job?" The devil now suggests that if you touch his body, he will curse you to your face. God gives the devil authority. The devil acts without mercy. And Job continues to be faithful. Now, what's interesting is, after this, Satan is no longer mentioned in the book of Job. But some commentators believe that he continues in his presence by proxy. In other words, he's still attempting to win this engagement with God. He's still trying to win this battle. If Job can be brought to utterly refuse God, then Satan wins. He's proven right. Now, Job only liked you for the stuff. And so if you want to take that view, then you see Job's wife as a proxy for Satan. You see Job's comforters as a proxy for Satan. All these used by Satan to continue the struggle that's established in Job 1 and 2. So that the devil might prove that there's nothing in God that is worthy of worship in and of himself. At the end of chapter 2, the three comforters are introduced. None of them are Israelites. And while many folks seem to think that this is the bright spot in their interaction, and perhaps it is, regardless, Christopher Ash is a well-known commentator on the book of Job, and he thinks that this is, at best, ambiguous about the intentions of the three friends. Because, interestingly, what they do when they get there, they lift up their voices, they weep, they tore their robes, they sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven, and they sat with him on the ground for 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him. This is exactly what is done for Jacob's death in Genesis 50, verse 10. And so Christopher Ash suggests that rather than a sign of solidarity with Job, this is more like a funeral, like you're dead already, and we're just kind of waiting for you to actually die. So he doesn't think that it's obviously a sign of solidarity with Job, that it's possible that we're seeing some of their motivations already. I don't know, and I don't have a side I'm taking on that. I just wanted to point out that that could be more ambiguous than we often take it. So the dialogues begin in verse 3, and like we said, verse 3 is the lament that kicks off the whole thing. Job regrets the day he's born and wishes he'd never been born, and that day would be ripped out of the calendar. Chapter 4, I got to move a little quicker. Eliphaz, in this first speech, can kind of give us the idea of what's going to happen through much of the rest of the book. And Eliphaz comes out swinging. There is no, like, it's dialed up to 11 almost immediately. If one ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? Yet who can keep from speaking? Like, I'm tired of you lamenting over here. I'm going to tell you what's really going on. And what's really going on, according to Eliphaz, starting in verse 6 in chapter 4, is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope. Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. And by the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed. And so there you have it stated boldly and plainly, the theology of the comforters. No one who is righteous ever perished, at least by God's hand. And those who act wickedly, they're going to get theirs. God's going to wipe them out spectacularly. But this is all with an earthly perspective, that God is going to settle all accounts in this life. And again, while the comforters say many things that are true, it's this underlying assumption that poisons everything. And Job's going to struggle with accepting this premise as he's going through his own roller coaster of emotions, trying to defend himself. For example, in verses 5, 8 through 16, we see Eliphaz expresses belief in the goodness of God, and many of the brothers, or the comforters, express belief in the goodness of God, the sovereignty of God. But then it's a setup for just fess up to whatever you did wrong to deserve all this, and the pain will go away. And we know from the prologue, God did not allow these things to be done to Job because he did something specifically wrong. And Job knows that he did not do something specifically wrong to merit punishment in this way. There is a very well-known bright spot in these dialogues in chapter 19. Verses 23 through 27. Ironically, Job says, "Oh, that my words were written, oh, that they were inscribed in a book," which they are. "Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has thus been destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me." So again, Job's on a roller coaster. There are times when he's shaking his fist at God. Then there's times like this where it's doxology. It's worship and trust. And this is really powerful. I mean, it's really interesting if this is one of the first books written in the Bible that he's talking about how he will in his flesh see God. "I know that my Redeemer lives." And there's a lot of fascinating things we can understand from that how much God has disclosed to his people in ages past before the Bible was completed. But Job is confident, even in his destitution and in all the accusations of his friends or comforters. Of course, they're not really his friends or comforters. But he has confidence and trust in God that carries him through much of this. But unfortunately, it doesn't carry him through all of it. He does initially give in. And we can look at chapter 31 and start in verse 35. And this is where the courtroom language is especially present. Job says, "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him." Yeah, yikes. And you can see the roller coaster Job's on. Because this is a relatively short period in which he says, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him in my flesh, and I have signed the signature on the court statement. I approach like a prince. I know I'm in the right." It's a little bit earlier. He says, basically, "I will cling to my righteousness to my death." So he's a mess, as you would expect he would be, given everything that he's experienced. So I skipped a little bit, but 31 is actually in the next section of the monologues. We've 30 and 31, 29. I think 29 begins the monologue section where Job is going to speak and not have a response from the three comforters. But 32 begins Elihu. And I got to skip over all this introductory stuff about Elihu, but I'm just going to say, I think Elihu is a warm-up, an appetizer for God's speech, that Elihu speaks mostly in the right, if not completely in the right. He sees the wickedness in Job that he's expressing in his pride and in his accusation of God, and he sees the wickedness of the three comforters, and he serves as kind of God's opening act, if we could even word it that way. And so I think that's all I can say right now because we're running out of time. 38 is when the Lord comes in a whirlwind. Oh, I do want to read this from Elihu real quick. 35, 13 through 16. Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. How much less when you say that you do not see him, that the case is before him, and you are waiting for him. And now, because his anger does not punish, and he does not take much note of transgression, Job opens his mouth in empty talk. He multiplies words without knowledge. And it's interesting that God, when he comes in Genesis, or Job 38, he says, he picks up on that same phraseology. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? When the Lord answers Job, Job gets his wish. God comes in person to answer Job's accusations, but it does not go the way Job thought it would. The Lord begins, and his dialogue or monologue with Job focuses really on, you think you can do better at governing the universe. Let me give you a taste of what governing the universe entails. And he begins in chapters, well, especially 38, we're looking at more natural occurrences. The stars, the rain, the sea, the snow. Can you govern any of these things? Do you have any knowledge of these things? If not, you really have no right to question my governance of the universe. In chapters 39, we see a lot of wild animals. Wild being untamable, strong. Mountain goats, wild donkeys, the wild ox, ostriches, horses, the hawk. Do you understand they're going out and they're coming in? Their breeding seasons, how they eat. Can you govern these? No. Then who are you to challenge my governance of the universe? And Job is famously given an opportunity to respond to everything God said, and Job rightly says, behold, I'm a man of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. He has been humbled even already, but the Lord is not finished. In chapter 40, God shows Job Behemoth, and in 41, he shows Job Leviathan. And it seems that these creatures are meant to be like the pinnacle of God's creation among land creatures and among sea creatures. And the point is basically the same. You can't begin to comprehend or control these things. How can you question my governance of the universe? So quickly, in 42, we come to the end of the book. And Job confesses and repents. Job intercedes for his three friends because the Lord condemns them. and Job receives a double blessing. Now, this is where the wheels can fall off the cart in our interpretation of the book if we're not careful. Because especially prosperity gospel folks want to say, well, Job repented, then he got his stuff back, and then some. But if that's the case, that destroys the whole message of the whole book. The point is that he repented while he had nothing, which means that God was worthy of worship in and of himself. The devil is wrong. And that Job did not need his stuff to repent. The stuff given back is all of grace and not a reward for repentance. And the double blessing can be difficult because a lot of folks are concerned that it takes away from the emotional impact of the book if he gets double back for everything he lost. But from what I've heard, we know that this is not the case for most people in this life, that whatever we lose, we get back and then double in this life, even the most faithful among us. But I would say that spiritually, this is true of every single believer in Jesus Christ. That everyone who loses anything will get back much, much more in glory with Christ. And I thought I wrote it down, but I didn't. But Jesus says as much in the Gospels, that anybody who loses anything for my sake will receive 100-fold back for that which is lost. And so the double blessing, we shouldn't see this as some kind of knot tied on the end of the story, some bow put on the end of the story that, well, he suffered a lot, but it all worked out in the end and they lived happily ever after, and it can with you too. We don't want to go that route. What we want to understand is that all of God's people will be blessed, if not in this life, then in the next life. I think there's eschatological significance to Job's restoration. How is Job, or if we're looking for Christ in Job, Job is a figure that should remind us of Christ, and I think should remind us of Christ in at least three ways. The first way is that Job is an innocent sufferer according to the prologue of the book. Now, we know not in the ultimate total depravity sense, no one's innocent, yes. But Job begins by saying that Job is blameless and upright, and his suffering is clearly not a punishment for some secret sin that Job committed. So he is, in a sense, an innocent sufferer. And of course, this points forward to Christ, who is, in every sense of the word, an innocent sufferer. Second way is that Job intercedes for his foolish friends just as Christ intercedes for his. At the end of the book, God condemns Job's three friends. I want to actually read it. 42, starting in verse 7. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "My anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken to me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For I will accept his prayer, not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken to me what is right, as my servant Job has." So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did what the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. And you see grounds for why Ezekiel says of Job what he says, that Job is one of these premier intercessors, but of course, Jesus is the greater intercessor for all of his very foolish friends. And the third, Job is used, in a sense, to defeat the devil. Because remember, this whole book begins with this engagement between God and Satan. And Satan basically saying, there is no reason to worship the Lord in and of himself. And Job is used to prove him wrong. That in the end, Job does repent without anything and worships God because he's worthy of worship. Obviously not because of him and his flesh, but by God's grace. But we see that in a sense, Job is used in a small way to defeat the devil. just as the God-man Jesus Christ is used in the ultimate sense to defeat the devil. So we have like 5 minutes. Are there any questions? And Coley?